Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And as you make your appeals to heaven, don't forget to continue learning, praying, and acting on those things that we're learning. As I have been saying, your campaign, your public relations campaign against those people who are violating their oath, whether they're at the county level, whether they're at the state level, we need to initiate an interposition campaign, calling them out by using petitions. Now, even if you're not interested in running for office, does not mean that you can't participate or even launch a PR campaign. You may become the logical person to, hey, you really understand this. Why don't you run for office? You may actually have an offer you can't refuse, but more importantly, you're not required. You can find and start developing somebody else in this upcoming election. So, being all things being equal, you need to get out and start getting in everybody's grill. We're ending the third month of the year. In other words, a quarter of the year is gone. So let's maximize what little time we have left. Now, the last thing I want to kind of cover is interposition is holding people accountable to their oath, not to the budget, not to whether they like your, what you're spending your money on or not. Bottom line, almost all the money being spent by government today is not authorized by we the people. Most of the things that have been coming down from the federal government, those are all usurpations. Those are all unconstitutional assumptions. They're creating, this is, goes back to the debt. It's all fraud. And what your state is doing, and in the fact that they're raising the taxes at the state level to keep pace with all these unconstitutional requirements by the federal government, it is a self-licking ice cream cone. This is a downward spiral to our demise. We need to interpose. We need to hold everybody accountable to their oath. This is why if the Department of Justice, if we didn't have a president seeking retribution, seeking vengeance, making everybody feel a little bit better, but not improving anything, nothing is changing. And the fact is, I don't think they care to change it. I try to give everybody the benefit of the doubt, and they've it's overwhelming how underwhelmed I am in the fact that they seem to continually fail to recognize what they should be doing, and they continue to fail, period. They're failing you, they're failing the Constitution, they're failing us. So please, let's just keep context and let's start actually bringing this to the surface. If the DOJ was completely revamped, retooled, got rid of everybody, and their sole purpose was to hold every public servant accountable, just remember, the few laws that they actually have are not that important compared to the insurgencies in all these different manners from conservatives and liberals. They all have their own insurgencies against the Constitution. Now, anybody that actually cares about the Constitution and they start doing the due diligence will absolutely stand up and say, you know what, I was wrong. We don't have the authority to do this. I thought we did. And they would start getting things right, if they actually care about the Constitution and the rule of law. Very few people do. Most people are only in it for themselves. There's no good way of saying it. I just get really frustrated when I keep on dealing with people directly that really don't care about the Constitution. They only care about what's in it for them. And it's hard to get, you know, it's hard to get people to break that paradigm because they really love themselves. We have a lot of people today that really love themselves, but I don't have time to dive into all of this. What I do have time to do is I'm going to get you content. We're going to go through the Paris Treaty that I promised you. But I need to basically lay this out. I had another prominent person who I connected with. I might have mentioned their name. And I believe that this person, because they seemed a bit shocked when I kind of explained to them about the Federalist Papers and why is it that organizations like the John Birch Society, you know, Eagles Forum and so forth, why is it that they cling to the Federalist Papers and they don't read the ratification debates? Why is it that they've completely void of the ratification debates in their positions and everything else? And so apparently, because I just received some a correspondence, hey, I'm way too busy to do anything with you, kind of a real put off, instead of being nice and saying, hey, or being honest and saying, hey, I did a little background check with, the JBS and some of these other people that I'm kind of close to, and they don't like you, and I'm not going to deal with you. Because these prominent people are, given these little token opportunities to travel and speak. Because the John Birch Society has this great network of entertainment where conservatives like, what's the guy's name? Alex Newman down in Florida. He goes around and starts talking about, and it seems like the only thing he really wanted to talk about that he kind of had his it was his subject matter expert type of criteria for him was the education system. Now, if Trump goes and dismantles this, is Alex Newman going to be going around saying, hey, no, he can't. That's not the proper way to do this. The only way to do this is Republic Review, because Alex Newman has actually obviated Republic Review. Alex Newman has actually gone down this path of trying to, get everybody to believe in this falsehood, or I should say this nullification was a big push by Alex Newman because of the John Birch Society. Everybody's going to get on board with this. I tried to convince him. I tried to show him in these documents. You better read these documents, because Madison's not saying that states can stay in the... Madison's really clear here. You cannot stay in the union if you're going to nullify laws. That you have to leave the union. Again, he also talks about the ultra interpositions that we need to actually use for self-preservation, but that's not the same as nullifying a law and or something that's being applied to the entire union. It's one thing to stand up when you're actually being attacked uniquely as a state. They're coming after you. You're taking their land and so forth. But anyway. Back to this point, since the John Birchers and many of these organizations continue to use ad hominem attacks, then I'm going to continually lay it out here for you folks. Interposition, First Amendment petitions, Republic Review, and the fact that the single most important documents, our true national treasure, are our ratification debates. And as long as they continue to use these subversive Federalist Papers, then they're only proving my point. As long as they stay away from diving into Republic Review and the process and the arguments made by Madison and Jefferson of those 1798 resolutions and their report or their follow-ups and the fact that they stayed in the... They didn't nullify. They stayed in the union because what they did was they went to the next level of interposition. They used the party and basically initiated a coup in calling out the Federalists. This is what they did. This goes back to your campaign needs to start now. This is what they did. They actually started calling out and pointing to all the Federalists that were in office, how they were violating their oath. and many of them got replaced. It was a it was the first red wave in American political election, period. In 1800, it was the very first red wave in the constitutionalists. Actually, let's call it a parchment wave. The parchment wave actually took back our government. And I believe that a parchment wave today can do this as well. It really, it's sad to see some of these third, you know, organizations, or I should say third party parties, or these outlier parties out there, like the Constitution Party and Socialist, I mean, Independent American Party. The Libertarian Party has just truly become, I guess the best way to call them is anarchist. But why is it that the Constitution Party and the Independent American Party, why aren't they not actually standing on the, you know, the ratification base and full interposition? Why are they not getting involved in First Amendment petitions? Why are they not standing up and demanding full compliance for every public servant? You must comply to the Constitution and oppose every infraction. Why? There's not a good answer out there, folks. But what we're going to do is we're going to cover the the Paris Treaty. And actually, if we want to call it anything, it's technically the title is the Definitive Treaty of Peace, 1783, Treaty of Paris. Now, what we're going to dive into is I'm going to prove to you today that when somebody tells you that the treaty, America, was co-opted by France, or actually co-opted by England, and that we basically got pulled back underneath them and we were their puppets because of the American signing of this treaty. And the real facts is, we're going to go through this, and it may take me into Friday. We'll see. It's just a few pages long, so we're going to dive into this. But what I want you to know is, I want you to know that there are people out there that are completely misrepresenting our history in these documents. Anna von Ritz and her own hyperbolic conspiracy theories. We need to start challenging all of these types of things that these people are doing. Don't believe what they're telling you. And read the supporting source documents. Read the actual document and then go actually challenge, why did this treaty get violated? Because the reality is, all you've got to do is do some due diligence and research, and you will find what ends up happening. Now, there's some of this part we're going to kind of skip over, like the second article, and I'll explain why. But this is the Definitive Treaty of Peace. In the name of the most holy and undivided Trinity. In other words, boy, that really reeks of Catholicism, doesn't it? Undivided, like all in one and omnipotent. And anyway, it having pleased the divine providence to dispose the hearts of the most serene and most potent prince George III, by the grace of God, King of Britain, France, and Ireland, Defender of the Faith, Duke of Brunswick and Lunenburg, Ark, Treasurer and Prince Elector of the Holy Roman Empire, etc. In other words, the king is identifying those major players in their empire, and the Holy Roman Empire being a part of that. And then, etc., dot, 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 and of the United States, to forget all past misunderstandings and differences that have unhappily interrupted the good correspondence and friendship which they mutually wish to restore. Now, I'm here to tell you, folks, that there was nothing that the king wanted to restore, and the reality was, he was only buying time, and he wanted to make concessions that were absolutely impossible, so we're going to dive into those. And to establish a beneficial and satisfactory intercourse between the two countries upon the ground of reciprocal advantages and mutual convenience, as may promote and secure to both perpetually peace and harmony, and having for this desirable end already laid the foundation of peace and reconciliation by the provisional articles signed at Paris on the 30th of November, 1782. Now, that's when the original Treaty of Paris was actually pounded out, these provincial articles, by the commissioners empowered on each part, which articles were agreed to be inserted and constitute the Treaty of Peace, proposed to be concluded by the Crown of Britain and the said United States, but which treaty was not to be concluded until terms of peace could be agreed upon between Great Britain and France, and His Britannic Majesty should be ready to conclude such treaty accordingly. In other words, Britain had this contingency that they put right here that said that they could move forward with this treaty as long as they got this treaty from France. And so moving forward, and the treaty between Great Britain and France having since been concluded, His Britannic Majesty and the United States of America, in order to carry into full effect the provisional articles mentioned, so the king got his treaty finally with France, and according to the tenor thereof, have constituted and appointed to say His Britannic Majesty on his part, and then they got, you know, David Hartley, Esquire, member of the Parliament of Great Britain. So that was one of the parties in this process. Then they identified everybody else, John Adams being an Esquire. Let me see here, who's the next one? Benjamin Franklin being an Esquire and John Jay being an Esquire. And so as we look at and these people signing this or involved in this treaty, why were they calling them Esquires? And there's a lot of people that have a real problem with the fact, oh, Esquire, Esquire. It's almost like it's a trigger word. And they just go, you know, into epileptic seizures when they see the word Esquire. Now, Esquire today by the British Bar Association is an emolument. It's a title of nobility. Back in those days, it was a recognition of a profession because at this point in time, as we were breaking and dividing, our legal system was literally going through an evolutionary process, just like Britain had been going through an evolutionary process since just after the death of Christ. Since just after the death of Christ, it wasn't until probably, what, I think 600-800 AD, when they created the Anglo-Saxon laws, and then they abandoned the Anglo-Saxon laws and the legal system they created, and they only did that because they were having problems. They didn't like the civil law that was inflicted upon them by the pagan Romans, and then the Anglo-Saxon law system or the legal system was pagan as well, and they said, you know what, we're going to institute common law. At the beginning of the millennia, they basically established common law. So they were going through this long evolutionary process as they finally ended up with their own monarchical theocracy that they basically were inflicting upon the world in tandem and working with the Roman Catholic Empire. The Holy Roman Empire is what they called it. Anyway, let me dive back into this. Now, the first article, because I'm just, everybody else was just formalities and announcing in the very beginning of the treaty. Now, here's the first article. And this is what's important. His Britannic Majesty acknowledges the said United States, viz., and goes out through every state's name from New Hampshire down to Georgia, to be free, sovereign, and independent states. And he treats with them as such, and for himself, his heirs and successors, relinquish all claims to the government property and territorial rights of the same and every part thereof. He did not create a treaty with Congress. He did not, you know, because he recognized it was Confederation and that he was creating a treaty with the independent states. However, there's a real problem and a real rub in this because we actually have to look at the Articles of Confederation. So let me go ahead and do that. You know, why not actually pull them up, right? And so when we look at the Articles of Confederation, what treaty powers were granted in the Articles? Well, you'll find that the word treaty or treat actually comes up five times. Let me see. Let me make sure that is correct. And treat actually comes up five times. No, eight times. So there's a treaty. No two or more states shall enter into a treaty. That's a restriction. The next one, no state shall lay any impost, may interfere with the stipulations and treaties entered by the United States Congress, nor in pursuance of the treaties already, blah, blah, blah. So nothing really there. So when we get to Article 9, this is where the meat is. The United States and Congress assembled shall have the sole and exclusive right and power of determining on peace and war, except in all cases mentioned in the sixth article, of sending and receiving ambassadors, entering, so that was dot, dot, right? And then sending them to receive ambassadors. So they had this responsibility of having their own ambassadors and sending and receiving, entering into treaties and alliances, provided that no treaty of commerce shall be made by the legislative power of the respective states. In other words, they're being constrained in these treaties that only Congress, Continental Congress, can create these treaties to end wars. That's what it's saying right there. And as we go a little bit further on, we'll actually find the United States, and this is down in Article 9 still as well. The United States and Congress assembled shall never engage in war, nor grant letters of marque or reprisal in peacetime, nor enter into any treaties or alliances, nor coin money. These are restrictions placed upon Congress. Nor regulate the value thereof, nor ascertain the sums and expenses necessary to the defense and welfare of the United States, blah, 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 emitting bills of money, credits, and so forth. And I'm going to go to the very end of this because it says, unless nine states assent to the same, nor shall a question on any other part except for the adjourning from day to day be determined unless the votes of the majority of the United States in Congress assemble. So in other words, for them to get a treaty passed, it required nine states to buy into it. Three-fourths. Not two-thirds, three-fourths. And so, just to be clear, Congress had the power. In other words, the treaty should have been ratified, this British treaty of 1783, because at this point in time, the Articles of Confederation had been ratified. Now, when the Provincial Articles was 1792, I think it was, what was it, September or something? No, it was, I think, actually before that. But anyway, it doesn't matter. 1782, the Articles of Confederation were almost fully ratified. They needed to get 100%. They didn't have it until March. So by the time this treaty was being ratified and accepted by Britain in September 1783, the Continental Congress had been fully ratified and basically been accepted by all the states as the grand poobah of treaties. And so the point is this, folks, that this treaty should have been with Congress, not identifying the independent states. So why is it? And as a matter of fact, when you look at the signers of this, they didn't have a representative from each state. As a matter of fact, we had a representative from New York, a representative from Massachusetts, and a representative from Pennsylvania. And Virginia was going to be another one because Thomas Jefferson was asked and basically was supposed to go, but because he was governor of Virginia at the time, he couldn't just step down. So what ended up happening is they only had the three, Jay, Franklin, and Adams, and they were the ones working out these provincial details. So anyway, as we move back down into the first article, the fact is that the king slapped Congress in the face, says, I don't recognize you. I'm only going to recognize these states, and I'm relinquishing all claims to the government of the states, not to you. The second article starts off with, and that all disputes which may arise in the future on the subject of boundaries of the United States may be prevented. It is hereby agreed and declared that the following are and shall be the boundaries. And then they go through this long, long page of describing how far from this, you know, area of woods and forest out to this water, you know, the river to the coastline to a bay. This is a huge paragraph of what they recognize as the land area that they are relinquishing to the United States, that they're going to abandon the, you know, the Northwest Territory. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so going through that second article is just a lot of land descriptions going from here to here of how they establish the boundaries. Very similar to the way they were establishing the boundaries of states in the Enabling Acts. Like Missouri, they went from this point down to, you know, along the river to this point and then in, you know, this direction. The way they were describing it is like they were reading it off of the map of what was being agreed upon that map was depicting. So it's not like they had the same kind of projections that we have today, but close enough to where they were able to get a very accurate layout of the boundaries. Now, to be clear, Britain was conceding. They were basically giving up the Northwest, or pretty much all of the territory going out to the Mississippi. And they were basically in this. They were going to actually, and we'll get to that. Let's just actually cover it. So the third article, it is agreed that the people of the United States shall continue to enjoy unmolested the right to take fish out of every kind of bank. So in other words, it's interesting that one of the things that they included as a token to the United States was the ability to use, you know, the Atlantic Ocean and some port parts of the northern area of the United States going up into Canada. And so what they do is they kind of lay this out on all the banks of Newfoundland, also in the Gulf of St. Lawrence and other places in the sea where inhabitants of both countries used and time heretofore to fish. And also to the inhabitants of the United States shall have liberty to take fish of every kind on such part of the coast of Newfoundland as British fishermen shall use, but not to dry or cure the same on that island. In other words, they couldn't do all the curing. And also on the coast, bays, creeks, and other of His Britannic Majesty's dominion in America. So they were already laying it out here. Well, we already still have dominion in America still. And that the American fishermen shall have liberty to dry and cure fish in any of the unsettled bays, harbors, and creeks of Nova Scotia, Magdalen Islands, and Labrador, as long as the same shall remain unsettled, but so soon as the same or either of them shall be settled, it shall not be for lawful use of the fishermen. In other words, if we make claim to the area, you can't use it to fish or to dry fish, to cure fish. So they were kind of laying this out as a token to the northeastern quadrant of the United States. Because we talk about this with the cod fishery bounties. Because the cod fishery bounties were basically trying to get bounties where they were getting welfare to help aid them in doing these things that they were needing to do. Anyway, Article 4, the fourth article. It is agreed that the creditors on either side shall meet with no lawful impediment to the recovery of full value in sterling money of all bona fide debts. In other words, anybody that had a debt with any banks in Britain or of the British Empire, they wanted to make sure that America would still honor those debts. And so they wanted to carry all of those things through. The fifth article basically says, it is agreed that Congress shall earnestly recommend to the legislatures of the respective states to provide for the restitution of all estates, rights, and properties which have been confiscated belonging to the real British subjects. In other words, these were the Tory acts. They're actually proving that the Tory acts were executed. You want some historical proof, folks? We kicked the loyalists, those who would not become a true supporter of the Constitution, which was coming down the pike, a true supporter of liberty, we kicked them out. We can do this today, folks. We are not obligated to keep the enemy among us. We can always repel the enemy. In other words, these woke people that are running around as communists, BLM and all these other people, they don't have a right to be here. Their job as a U.S. citizen is to support that Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic, and be willing to take up arms. Since they're taking up arms against the Constitution, they have crossed the line. They should be revoked of their citizenship. And we should literally start talking and having conversations about where we start sending these folks. Because we have the legal precedents in our own history. We do not tolerate this crap. So anyway, they're basically laying this out that the Continental Congress is going to earnestly recommend to the legislatures of the states to pay back. And also of the estates, rights, and properties of persons resident in districts in the possession of His Majesty's arms and who have not borne arms against the United States. In other words, this article right here, and I'm not going to go through it in all the details, but I'm going to highlight very specific parts because this is all about the king wanting us to have to pay restitution for kicking out their enemies and actually allowing the enemies to stay among us. In other words, he still wants to have the Tories and loyalists actually live among us so that he can continually use them as spies in waging or preparing to wage his next wave of attacks. So it goes on a little bit further, and you'll actually find, and that Congress shall also earnestly recommend to the several states a reconsideration of the revision of all acts, laws regarding the premises, so as to render all of these acts and laws as illegal. And the Congress also earnestly recommend to the several states that the estates, rights, and properties of the last mentioned persons shall be restored to them. In other words, they were demanding that we allow the enemy to live with us. Now, because we got a concession and New York and basically Adams and Jay, New York and Massachusetts bought in. Oh, yeah, we can go with that. Well, I don't believe Benjamin Franklin was necessarily on board. I don't know why he would, because why would he care if the fisheries, were going to be maintained and they could have this business? Anyway, at the very bottom of Article 5, and it is agreed that all persons who have any interest in confiscated lands, either by debts, marriage, settlements, and otherwise, shall meet with no lawful impediment in the prosecution of their just rights. In other words, we're just going to bow down and allow them to re-implant their spies among us. Article 6, there shall be no future confiscation. So in other words, Article 5 and 6 is all about how we were confiscating and kicking them out. Article 7, there shall be a firm and perpetual peace between the Britannic Majesty and the said states, and the said states, not Continental Congress, and between the subjects of the one and the citizens of the other, were for all hostilities by both. So in other words, what was the great concessions that we were supposed to get? To me, this was a crappy treaty, and it goes on to basically in the eighth article, the navigation of the Mississippi from its source. So we got our land and we got access to the Mississippi. That's what the eighth article gives us. But that's about it. And then the ninth article, in case it should so happen that any place or territory belonging to Britain or the United States should have been conquered by the arms of either from the other before the arrival of the said provisional articles in America, it is agreed that the same shall be restored. So in other words, Britain was really worried about losing some of their holdings. And the 10th article, the solemn ratifications of the present treaty, expedient in good and due forms, shall be exchanged between the contracting parties in the space of 6 months or sooner. So, in other words, this was done September 3rd, 1783. So they were going to go for 6 months, and that would have taken us into March of 1784. When this was all going to be said and done and must be ratified. The real question is, was this ratified? The real question, folks, is what really happened? We signed this. Those guys signed it. Well, I already gave you the Articles of Confederation required that Congress actually ratify it, right? And they needed 9 states to actually ratify it as well. Did that happen? Actually, this is what happened. Britain violated the treaty of 1783 by the following. They failed to evacuate the forts that they were occupying. The treaty stipulated that Britain would relinquish control over forts in the Northwest Territory, quote, with all convenient speed, close quote. However, British troops remained stationed at 6 forts in the Great Lakes region and 2 of the north end of Lake Champlain. This refusal to evacuate these forts was a major point of contention and a clear violation of the treaty. The next one, they continued seizures of American ships and goods. The British continued to seize American ships and goods, particularly those bound for France. Despite the treaty's provision, this action, along with other issues like naval impressment and trade restrictions, further strained relationships between the two nations. And Jay's Treaty later on, with the Treaty of Paris, resolved the immediate issues of the Revolutionary War. It left several unresolved problems, such as the Northwest Territory forts and those types of things, and which basically created and ensued the War of 1812. But what did America do? Did we actually follow the treaty? The treaty required the United States to honor debts owed to British creditors before the Revolutionary War. However, the American states, struggling with economic instability and a weak central government, proved reluctant to enforce these obligations, leading to failure to repay many of these debts. So in other words, we didn't pay these debts that we were kind of obligated to by these other banks. We're not talking about, you know, Britain asking us to pay them, you know, retribution or to pay for them losing the war. Not at all. These were actual, you know, debts that were sought after for whatever business, whatever states, whatever. But what else did the Americans do? They continued to seize Loyalist property. The treaty was stipulated that the United States would cease the confiscation of property belonging to Loyalists who had supported the British Crown during the war. However, the states continued to seize Loyalist properties, kicking them out and further straining relations with Great Britain. So bottom line, it comes down to this, folks. And as a matter of fact, I don't believe we have a true number because they were executing this concept of repelling these invaders. I want you to understand what I just said. They were actually finding these people who were actually paying for the British war, providing information. They were loyalists. We can find that it was easily 100,000 people that were kicked out, either got on ships and went back to Britain or went up north into Canada. They lost their land. The only thing they were able to take, and it wasn't their valuables, like their, you know, the royal jewelry or whatever it was that they had that was highly valuable, all of that stuff was taken. That was all confiscated and it was sold off, which is one of the reasons why Britain demanded that we actually go down this path of repaying for all of that and giving it all back to them and doing everything we could to kiss their feet so that all of these people could come back, reoccupy these houses and their property so that they could continually spy on us so Britain could attack us again. And so since things weren't working out so well for Britain, and we kept on continuing to stand up against them, if the United States, under the Constitution, which formed in 1789, had the American government actually been paying Britain, and because we actually started paying off France, we started paying off Holland, we actually were paying the world debt to everybody but Britain. As a matter of fact, because of the way Britain had behaved in failing to, you know, honor the treaty, that we actually had to extend more effort in taking the Northwest Territory and the Western lands because they refused to give it up. And as a matter of fact, they were constantly trying to throw in these extra treaties. Oh, well, we'll, you know, as long as you create a treaty with the Indians and do this, because when you read the Treaty of Ghent, that's one of the things that they tried to do as well. Britain was a mastermind of manipulation in trying to make everything look, you know, as we were the bad guys. Bottom line, had America been honoring and paying under the Constitution, as so many people like Anna von Ritz and other people want to tell you, oh yeah, they were paying it back. We were already in cahoots with them. They would not have come to America and burnt down D.C. and attacked us in 1812. That does not seem to me like the king has gotten his little puppet government the way he wanted it. As a matter of fact, the fact of the matter is he was actually looking at America becoming more and more distant from them. And as when we look at the War of 1812, what happened in the war in that year of 1812? 1812 was the year that the 13th Amendment was ratified. I'm telling you, folks, that the fact is we sent them a message that we weren't going to have anything to do with their legal crap or anything. And we weren't going to allow them any footing in America for their lawyers to establish a bar or anything like that, which is why the amendment, the 13th Amendment, basically made it illegal for a person to remain a citizen of the United States if they received a title of nobility from the bar. Go read the 13th Amendment. It's in our color-coded Constitution. And as you read that, you'll actually see that the only way a person could maintain, they couldn't be a public servant at all. And the only way they could actually become a public servant and maintain their citizenship is it would require, I think, 2/3 of both houses of Congress to allow them to actually maintain their citizenship and to become a public servant or what have you. In other words, Congress had to actually approve of this. And because that actually passed, Congress wasn't very approving of this. It took another 60-plus years before Britain had finally spent enough money in a propaganda campaign and in basically trying to undermine us in political, over political control, because they were corrupting us. They were corrupting our politicians, which gave them the Organic Act of 1871. So in 1871, when the Organic Act finally passed, this is when Britain finally crossed the threshold of having enough political control, enough influence in American politics to where they actually allowed, or I should say where Congress actually came right out and violated the Constitution in creating a state. We're going to cover this when we get to the ratification debates, because it is paramount that everybody understands exactly how the Organic Act was a direct violation by allowing the federal government, for the federal government to try to attempt to create a state out of D.C., out of the district, out of the seat of government or the District of Columbia. So when we look at this treaty, there's no evidence there for anybody to say, ah, look at that treaty. That only proves that we were their little strapling. We were just, you know, we were under their control. They had control over us. And I'm here to tell you, folks, that those assertions are outright misrepresentations and lies. So the fact is that we're looking at historical facts, source documents, and we're actually looking at the history. There is no other source documents out there that support these theories. You read the document by itself and you go, yeah, that's a crappy treaty. And look, if we actually honored that treaty, then we gave Britain basically almost everything they wanted. And we only got what, fisheries? Oh, and the Western lands. That's it? Come on, we just won a war and they were able to walk away with maintaining their grip and their spies and holding the property and basically being able to leverage banking and those types of things. I'm here to tell you that Britain was, they suffered a mighty blow out of that Revolutionary War. So much so that, and they were apt, they were determined to actually come back into America and take us back. And so the real question that I would ask is, why is it that King George, so when King George died, right? How old was he? When did King George die? Well, he died January 29th, 1820. So in other words, while he was getting old and decrepit, he wanted to make sure he closed the deal and brought America back. And he didn't get it. So after King George failed, then it was Britain's, you know, sole purpose in life for the monarchy to actually undermine America and destroy us one way or another. And they started with their manipulations, and it just over time, it was more and more and more. And I'm telling you that there's good evidence. I don't have hard evidence, but there's good evidence that Hamilton was working with Britain in trying to undermine us. The Federalist Papers are only proof of the fact, and his letters during the ratification debates that we've talked about already on this show, that Hamilton was working diligently in trying to undermine our Constitution by getting the justices to assume more responsibility than the Constitution granted them. So the fact of the matter is when we start looking at how people take American history, they take these source documents and they find these artifacts, and I believe many of the artifacts that have come forward, other than the Federalist Papers and those types of things, there are probably records, journals, letters between somebody and somebody else that have been generated, because this has happened for years and years. And as a matter of fact, our framers have been attacked historically over the past century by the progressives. One of the things that they needed to do to help everybody lose this luster and this affinity for our liberty and for the Constitution, the best way to do it is to make us have disdain for their, you know, the slavery and the bigotry and, you know, the evil of these men, these angry, mean white men that, you know, were just mean to everybody. They weren't nice. So the point is that when we look at these futile attacks, go find me the real source documents to actually prove that what they were doing was what they were saying they were doing. There's many that speak ill of George Washington. I will speak ill of George Washington only in the fact that I know he didn't know what he was doing. He didn't know what he was doing when he became president. And everybody says, oh, well, he was a lapdog for Britain. Well, if that's so, then why is it that he basically leaned on Madison, James Madison, for writing everything of his responses back to Congress? later on, when Madison and Jefferson kind of split their ways because of, or not Madison and Jefferson, Washington with Madison and Jefferson split their ways because there was a falling out between these two men and Hamilton. And Washington made a big mistake in backing Hamilton. This was after his second second term started. And so when we look at what happened, you can tell that Washington started actually leaning towards and listening to and following Hamilton more and more. In many ways, Washington, in the very beginning, like on the National Bank, Washington actually used consensus. He went around to the states and said, do you care if we create a national bank? No, not really. He didn't rely completely on Hamilton as he did probably in his second term, or as much as he did in his second term. But in the first term, when it came to every response back to Congress, the very first few years, James Madison wrote those correspondences for him. And I'm here to tell you that there's no evidence that anybody else had that much influence on him. Washington thought very highly of James Madison, but he thought more highly of Hamilton because of their time spent in the war. So bottom line, when we really start looking at the theories out there, these conspiracy theories from Anna von Ritz and everybody else, I'm just telling you that they can't prove anything. This is why when you look at the document, they give you a couple of highlights and they say, see right here, we paid them back. Oh, give me the evidence that we paid them back, because actually our history and our documents prove that we didn't. Even in the budget and the outlays of the American Treasury of the United States under Congress, under the Constitution, there is no evidence of any payments back to Britain, at least not in the very first few years. Now, as we kind of move forward, as we look at all of the other types of things, that there are people that have made derogatory points and they've tried to actually, why is it that so many patriot groups have given up on the 13th Amendment? Why is that? We've got hard documents that actually prove that the 13th Amendment was legitimately passed in 1812. So why is it that there's so many patriot groups that are being misled by these organizations, as I mentioned before, whether it be Anna von Ritz or whether it be the John Birch Society? Nobody is leading us on the truth. And so bottom line, we actually have to start challenging everything. And we actually need to find those who are willing to put aside their self-interests and actually say, we all need to unite and work together. You don't need to be a due-paying member of the John Birch Society to work with us so that we can all seek full compliance to the Constitution by every public servant out there. If we demand full compliance, not just we want Second Amendment rights preserved. We want you to keep these weak bills, in protecting your Second Amendment rights. But that's it. No, we need to demand full compliance, folks. They can't be myopic. We can't allow these subversive organizations to continually divide us. That is what's been happening. And if we're going to actually win this, we need to unite. United we stand, divided we fall. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.